My title this morning is You Ain't Called Israel for Nothing. So what's in a name? Well, in my family, we really pride ourselves and also kind of make fun of ourselves for being a Dutko. The expression, you know, that's so Dutko or something like that is one used commonly throughout my extended family with my brothers and sisters and others. And it could refer to, you know, being very resourceful. Some might say cheap, but we would say thrifty. And wise stewards is how we would say. But our family loves, you know, thrift stores and bargain shopping and all that, mostly because we never had a lot of money growing up. But we're known to kind of figure out a way to use everything in the refrigerator and leave nothing to waste or never throw anything away and just kind of make it work. We, of course, associate certain foods with being a Dutko as a part of our Polish and Slovakian heritage. We you know, love to eat kabasi and pierogies and poppy seed roll at holidays. But then there's also my mom's Italian side, where we love, you know, rich dark coffees and Italian desserts, and of course a little bit of Italian language thrown in there. Both my grandfather and great grandfather spoke Italian, and so, you know, we would kind of use some of that in the family as well. And I could go on and on, but the truth, of course, would be there's lots of positive things about being a Dutko, things and traditions that I really want to pass on to my kids that I want them to know and to love. And then there's some, of course, not so good things that I hope to save my kids from and with the Lord's help not pass on to them from my family. And I'm sure you can think of the same in your own family as well. Well, Israel, I think, was kind of the same way. They took great pride in being called Israelites, descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, who was later named Israel, and so was their namesake. And there was lots to be proud of, and there were some good qualities from their namesake Israel, but there were also some things not to be so proud of, some legacies better left not passed on. And my title this morning has that double message in a way that I believe Hosea is challenging Israel here to say positively, you're not named Israel for nothing. Meaning live up to your namesake. Be who you're supposed to be as Israelites. But then he's also critiquing them in a way, saying in the end, unfortunately, you're no different than your namesake Israel. In other words, you're such an Israelite. Just like we would say in my family, you're such a Dutko. And in that time, you're using it pejoratively, right? So what I want to do is explore these themes. After the introduction of the first two verses, I want to break this passage down then in the outlines on the back of your bulletin into three sections in order to grasp what Hosea is doing here and what it means to us. So I want to talk about first the antecedent, Jacob and deception. And then we'll move on to the antidotes, justice and devotion, verse 6, and then the anticlimax, juxtaposition and denial, verses 7 through 14. And I'll explain those terms when we come to them in case you're unfamiliar. And this is actually possibly maybe the most difficult passage so far in terms of trying to outline it or prepare a message, yet perhaps the most intriguing or at least the most artful or intelligent passage in Hosea, which is, of course, saying a lot for Hosea, as we've seen. So this section is really, it's an intricately developed case against Ephraim or Israel, same referring to the same people. Hosea is going to use the life story of Jacob to highlight Israel's shortcomings, as well as challenge them and show them how far they have fallen. And he's going to say, basically, you know, you ain't called Israel for nothing. And that sort of summarizes what I think Hosea is trying to say. So let's start with what seems to be the introductory verses in 11:12 and 12:1 to introduce this morning. So Hosea starts, Ephraim has surrounded me, kind of speaking with the voice of God, I guess. Ephraim has surrounded me with lies, Israel with deceit, and Judah is unruly against God, even against the faithful one. Ephraim feeds on the wind. He pursues the east wind all day and multiplies lies and violence. He makes a treaty with Assyria and sends olive oil to Egypt. So these verses sort of lay out what's then called the charge in verse 2 that God is bringing against Israel. And as Hosea often done, he communicates it both literally as well as poetically. So in the very straightforward language of 11:12, Israel is lying, deceitful, and unruly against God, and in very stark contrast against the faithful God. Then in the more metaphorical or kind of poetic language of the next verse in 12:1, it says Israel feeds on, or probably better translated, shepherds the wind. And this is sort of a prophetic sarcasm here, that he shepherds the wind in the idea that who does that, right? Like, who can shepherd the wind? I mean, they didn't know the modern technologies, I guess, that we now have, someone said on Wednesday. But it symbolizes fruitless pursuits and activities, that can you shepherd the winds? And the answer, of course, would be no. And even worse, these pursuits are not only fruitless, they are actually harmful. It says, he pursues the east wind all day and multiplies lies and violence. And the east wind would have been something to avoid. So as you see on the map here, you have the dry, hot winds coming to the east. See how in the east it's all desert, right? You want the cool, nice wind coming off the Mediterranean, the west wind, right? And so Hosea says, Israel pursues the east wind all day. So he's saying this is a fruitless and even harmful pursuit, this hot, dry wind that is to be avoided. And the idea here is that Israel passionately pursues this fruitless, this harmful wind, standing for these harmful activities, and they pursue it all day. I mean, they are all in. They're consumed with this pursuit. Some of this is explained in the last part of this verse in verse 1, that he makes a treaty with Assyria and sends olive oil to Egypt. This is not just, you know, your normal everyday trade. These are political actions that Israel is taking. They're putting their energies and trust into foreign alliances rather than in God. So in summary, and we've seen this before in Hosea, Israel puts all its energy, devotion, and pursuits toward the wrong things, and as a result has become liars and deceivers as they drift further from Yahweh their God. And what Hosea is about to say is, you know, you're just like your namesake. In other words, it runs in the family. So let's move on to point one, the antecedent, meaning the opposite of a descendant would be an antecedent, or the originator, the precursor, and that is Jacob and his deception. The life of Jacob here is divided into two parts, with verse 3 sort of being the key summary and middle, which represents the two sides or the traits of Jacob, one negative and one positive. I mean, it's a brilliant layout by Hosea here, and it's sort of the cliff notes or the brief sermon notes on the life of Jacob, which is all Israel needed because they would have been very familiar with the life of their namesake. His first point in the first part is that Jacob was a deceiver. And in that department, he says, Israel is living up to its name. Just a little background on Jacob, in case you're not familiar with the story. You can find it in Genesis 25 to 35. It's a very large story. It takes up about one-tenth or one-fifth of the book of Genesis. But in Genesis 25, 24, and 26, it tells us about Jacob. It says, when the time came for her, meaning Rebekah, to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first came out and was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. Now, being the firstborn is a very, very big deal in this culture. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So the idea is Jacob is already scheming. He's kind of like, I want to be the firstborn, right? So he's grabbing the heel. So he was named Jacob, which just means one who grasps the heel. Just means heel. So Jacob, or Jacob, means heel. It's just alluding to his supplanting, his deceiving ways, that he grasps the heel. It's a Hebrew idiom for he takes advantage of, or he deceives. So right from birth, Jacob is scheming. He's trying to be the firstborn, grabbing Esau's heel. Later on, if you know the story, Jacob dresses up. He pretends to be Esau before his father, who was basically blind at the time, and he asks for his father's blessing that is rightfully due Esau, the firstborn, before Isaac dies. And his mother Rebecca's in on the whole thing. I mean, it's deception to the max. And then we get Genesis 27, 30 and 36, which is this story that I'm talking about, where it says, after Isaac finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence. So Jacob comes to receive the blessing. He's dressed as Esau. His brother Esau came in from hunting. He too prepared some tasty food, and Rebekah had helped Jacob, and brought it to his father. Then he said, my father, sit up, eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing before you die. His father Isaac asked him, who are you? I'm your son, your firstborn, Esau. And Isaac trembled violently and said, who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate it just before you came, and I blessed him, and indeed he will be blessed. The power of words in this culture. When Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me too, my father. But he said, your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing. Esau said, isn't he rightly named Jacob, deceiver? This is the second time he has, and you don't pick this up in the English, it says, this is the second time he has taken advantage of me, but it actually says, this is the second time he has Jacobed me. This is the second time he's Jacobed me. Kind of like, you got Jacobed. He took my birthright, and that was the story before, which I didn't mention, and now he's taken my blessing. So with those stories in mind, now let's look at verse 2 and the first half of 3, which summarizes this kind of first half of Jacob's life. It says, the Lord has a charge to bring against Judah. He will punish Jacob according to his ways and repay him according to his deeds. In the womb, he grasped his brother's Jacob heel. So he's actually using the name of Jacob, but he's using it in the terms of heel. So the question would be asked, well, why does Hosea bring Jacob to his argument? Because he's their namesake, right? He's highly esteemed. It's kind of like, we're Israelites, just like in my family, we might say, you know, we're Dutkos, right? I mean, there's a certain kind of sense of pride in that. And, you know, the Israelites is kind of like, we're the people of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, that refrain. And Hosea is saying, indeed you are. You are deceivers and liars, just like Jacob, and you will be punished for it. And the theme of deception, it's not new in Hosea. We've seen it many times. But the way Hosea powerfully makes his case here with Jacob and basically says, this is no new story for you, Israel. But Jacob and his story is not all bad. The second part of this Hosea text then brings out the positive qualities of Jacob that make him actually a fairly endearing character in Genesis as well. In case you're not familiar with the Jacob story, after he steals Esau's birthright and blessing, Jacob flees in chapter 27 of Genesis. Then he encounters God at Bethel. This is the key turning point in Jacob's life. In chapter 28, he has the stairway to heaven dream, so to speak. Then he serves Laban for 14 years for a wife in Genesis 29. And then he flees Laban in chapter 31. And then we come to this key story in chapter 32 of Jacob struggling or wrestling with God. So let's read this text because this is the other one Hosea is referring to. So Genesis 32, verses 22 to 30. It says, that night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Then the man asked, what is your name? And Jacob, he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he replied, why do you ask my name? Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, It is because I saw God face to face, which is what Peniel means, and yet my life was spared. So he obviously interprets this as encounter with God, what we'd call a theophany in the Old Testament. Soon after this, Jacob then weeps upon his reunion with Esau, and then he returns again to Bethel later, which is the part of the promised land of Canaan that God had promised, and encounters God again, and God would again reaffirm his name as Israel in chapter 35. So this name Israel that he's given, Israel literally means to struggle or to wrestle with God. So in the Hebrew, Yisrael, so Yekah, which is where we get the Yeh, means to struggle with God or to wrestle with God. The Yekah means to prevail against somebody. So that's the Yeh. Sarah means to struggle or to wrestle. So Yeh, Sarah, and then El is the shortened form of Elohim for God. So it literally means one who prevailed after struggling with God, or struggled with God and prevailed, Yisrael. It's kind of a complicated name in a way, but it all goes back to this story where Jacob's name is changed to one who wrestles with God, struggles with God, and prevails. And it's a name that portrays kind of tenacity and strength that, you know, Jacob says, I will not let go until you bless me. It's kind of the stubbornness of Jacob coming out in the best of ways in relation to God. So with those stories in mind, let's read the other half of this depiction of Jacob, the positive side Hosea gives in the second half of verse 3 through verse 5. So we read, right, in the womb he grasped his brother's heel. That's the end of the negative parts of Jacob. But now he starts the second half. As a man, he struggled with God, Yisrael. He struggled with the angel and overcame him. He wept and begged for his favor. He found him at Bethel and talked with him there. The Lord God Almighty, the Lord Yahweh, is his name. So Jacob wrestled with God. He prevailed. He encountered him face to face at Bethel. He talked with him there, it says, and he learned about who God was because of it. God revealed himself as Yahweh to Jacob. So yes, I mean, Jacob was a deceiver, he was a liar, especially early on in his life, and he suffered for it, and he had to flee his home, but then he eventually encountered God. That was the key turning point in his life. He struggled with him, and then God changed his name from Jacob, deceiver, to Yisrael, one who struggles with God and yet prevails. It's an idea of encountering God. So I believe what Hosea is saying here, or going to say as we move through this, is you have all the qualities of Jacob and yet none of the qualities of Israel. It's a key verse, this verse 3, where he puts them both together. You are only living up to the bad parts of your namesake, Hosea says, and you have none of the good. So what's the solution? What is the antidote, meaning the cure, the remedy? Point 2 is to seek justice and devotion. So verse 6, you have to connect it to what just came before it. So it says, but you, or probably better translated here, so you, or therefore you. And the idea is, like Israel, which this what we just finished in verse 5, like Jacob or like Israel, so you must return to your God, like Jacob returned to Bethel. Maintain love. This is the word chesed, right? We know this word, most important word in the Old Testament, probably this devoted love, this faithful love. Maintain love and justice, mishpat, the other very, very important word in the Old Testament, and wait for your God always. So beside this being a constant refrain in the prophets, you think of Micah 6:8, right, that you are to act justly, love mercy, chesed, walk humbly with your God. Hosea here is just brilliantly drawing on Jacob's life to say this is who you're supposed to be. You're not named Israel for nothing. And he's saying here, start living up to your name. You want to be Israel? Well, return to your God like Jacob returned to Bethel. Bethel just means house of God, a place of encountering God. He says, you want to be called Israel? Well, then learn the ways of God by pursuing him, wrestling with his heart, learn the ways of faithful devotion and justice. Show some tenacity, Israel, like your forefather Jacob. Show some desire. You want to be like Israel? Well, instead of pursuing the east wind all day, as it says in verse 1, wait for your God always, as it says in verse 6. You see the juxtaposition that's taking place here. Just as Jacob persevered with God in his struggle, he waited 14 plus years for God's plan to unfold as he served Laban and waited for a wife. As it says in verse 12, Jacob fled to the country of Aram. He served to get a wife and to pay for it. He tended sheep. Jacob was willing to wait for what he wanted. He showed determination and tenacity. And Hosea is saying, you know, it would be nice to see that in you, Israel, directed toward God. So the basic summary is Israel is moving backwards, not forward. They're more like Jacob before he was named Israel, moving in the opposite direction. They should be more like Israel, pursuing God with devotion and tenacity while leaving behind the characteristics of Jacob, the deception and the lies. I mean, they knew more about God than Jacob did. They had the law, they had the revelation of God, things that Jacob didn't have. So they had even more, and yet they're actually regressing in their understanding of God. Israel is pursuing other things. So you see what Hosea has done here. Just a brilliant move of weaving all this together to make his point. So I wish, of course, that we could just end here. But as in every other section pretty much of Hosea, think of chapter 6 and others, it unfortunately doesn't have much of a happy ending. I mean, Hosea didn't have preachers in mind when he was trying to write this, you know, preachers writing sermons. Because, you know, he just never ends on that high note. He certainly didn't have seeker-sensitive churches in mind. God bless them, of course. But how great it would be just to end on, return to your God, maintain love and justice, wait for God always, and then Israel repents and says, yes, that is who we are. We are Israel. Let's be like that. But rather than end on that climax, Hosea ends on what can only be described as the anticlimax, the letdown that starts in verse 7 in this section of juxtaposition and denial. Juxtaposition, of course, is just placing two things close together or side by side in order to compare and to contrast them. It's just a comparison. And this whole section is really a compare and contrast with Israel, Jacob, and Israel, the nation. We just saw the positive attributes of Jacob, but now we'll see the sharp contrasts with what comes next as Hosea goes back to painting the picture of deception and denial. So we have that beautiful verse in verse 6, but then the very next verse, the merchant uses dishonest or deceitful, so he's drawing on the Jacob tradition, deceitful scales and loves to defraud, to deceive. Ephraim boasts, I am very rich. I have become wealthy. With all my wealth, they will not find in me any iniquity or sin. So there's the deception, and now here's the denial. You can't find any sin in us, even though they are full of deception and full of lies. And they deny it because they've been kind of put to sleep by their prosperity, by their sense of self-sufficiency, which has led to a blindness of sin. And then God's answer in verse 9, I have been the Lord your God ever since you came out of Egypt. I will make you live in tents again as in the days of your appointed festivals. We've seen this before in Hosea, right? That, you know, God is saying, who gave you the ability to make those riches? Where did you come from? I found you as slaves in Egypt. I can send you back. I gave it, I will take away. Israel is moving backwards, back to Egypt, back into the wilderness, and it's heartbreaking to watch this unfold because it's not what God desires for Israel. And that's why the book of Hosea is all about the broken-hearted God who is not doing what he wants to do, but what he has to do. It's not like God didn't give them a chance, right? Verse 10 says, I spoke to the prophets. I gave them many visions, and I told parables through them. Verse 13, the Lord used a prophet to bring Israel up from Egypt. By a prophet he, and then it uses this very tender word, shamar, by a prophet he cared for, he shepherded them, he watched over them. But Israel just won't listen. Israel has no need for a prophet. Why do they? They're self-sufficient. They're wealthy. They're fine. Verse 14, Ephraim has aroused his bitter anger. The Lord will leave on him the guilt of his bloodshed and will repay him for his contempt. They are not willing to struggle like Jacob, to put up a fight. They're not waiting for God like Jacob. They're not willing to work at their relationship with God. See, Jacob's arrogance was broken, but his eagerness remains. Israel has all the bad qualities of Jacob and none of the good. So what's the conclusion? What's the application to this whole text? It's very intricate. I had to kind of take some time to develop it so you could see what Hosea is doing here. I actually think the application is pretty simple. That we need to passionately pursue the heart of God, and ultimately, passionately pursue Jesus. See, the anticlimax in this verse, of course, points to the climax of the whole biblical story, which is Jesus. That we don't want to be like Israel in this passage, that we don't want to maintain our pride and arrogance and do things our own way, but we want to throw ourselves upon Jesus, who will take upon your guilt and punishment that in verse 14 is given to Israel that we deserve, but that Jesus took for us. And the compassion of God in this text, how he sent them prophets, how he cared for them is spilled out in the life of Jesus. At the very beginning of the book of Hebrews, we learn that in the past, it says, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways as a part of his compassion. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he also made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory. We talked about that last week. And the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. See, if Israel is being accused of moving backwards in the wrong direction, despite having more revelation, more understanding than even Jacob had because they had received the law, how much more do we need to be careful that we aren't regressing, moving backwards when we've received the revelation of Jesus Christ and his Holy Spirit, as we talked about last week, living in us, the hope of glory. On this side of the new covenant, I mean, there is even less excuse not to be pursuing the heart of God. I mean, we have the opportunity to know more about God and, more importantly, to personally know God than Israel ever had through the cross, the resurrection, the gift of his Spirit's. And we're responsible for that. I mean, let alone the resources, the access to the Bible and things that we have in this day and age, just makes me think of Jesus, to whom much is given, much will be required. So are we more like Jacob, or are we more like Israel, pressing forward, pressing on? Hosea's question to Israel, but it's also, I think, the text's question to us. Are you passionate about the wrong things, your own desires, your own scheming, or the right things, wrestling with the heart of God? And there's really, I mean, there's no other option in life, honestly. Either you're running toward the heart of God, or you're running away from the heart of God. Everybody's going in a direction. It's kind of like Bono says, to summarize him, it's a great line about music. He says, all music's about two things. It's either about running toward God, or it's about running away from God. And basically everything can be put into one of those two categories. And really life is just like that. Are you pursuing the wind? Are you pursuing fruitless activities? Or even worse, pursuing an east wind, meaning harmful things? pursuing the wrong things. I mean, both sides of Jacob were very passionate. That was his personality. But one was directed in the right direction, and one was not. The reality is we're going to be held responsible and accountable for the opportunity we have to know God and to introduce others to the living God. Israel was passionate about the wrong things. I mean, yeah, they still called on God, as we've seen throughout Hosea. They said some of the right things. They did their duties. They called themselves Israelites. But they were far from the heart of God. So, of course, the kind of sub-application to pursuing the heart of Jesus is we might call ourselves Christians, but like Israel, are we living up to our namesake? To be a Christian, of course, Christ Dian, just means to be a little Christ, right? It's a representative of Christ. That's a huge title to carry. That you are a Christ Dian. You are a little Christ. So we want to listen to the voice of God. What is being said? Are we representing our namesake? Because Israel wasn't. And it was breaking the heart of God. Because he knew it was ruining his ability to bless the nations, to do what he wanted to do, which was eventually bring all people under his name. And Israel was meant to be that light, and they couldn't do it. They weren't functioning the way God created them to be. And it's the same way with the church, the new Israel. Are we living up to our namesake, Jesus Christ? Are we looking more and more like Jesus, being transformed, as we talked about last week, into that ever-increasing glory? If the band wants to come up. I mean, I hope that we all feel this heart. I mean, I just feel this just week after week, where I just think, Lord, the harvest is so plentiful. I mean, the needs are so great. And yet the laborers are so few. And I think it just breaks God's heart because there's so much that he can do and wants to do, but we have to have our hearts in tune with his. We have to be wrestling with the heart of God. We got to be a bit tenacious like Jacob in pursuing the heart of God. We have to spend time pursuing him, wrestling with his heart, to show some tenacity, to pray, to fast, to be on our face. I mean, we're passionate about so many things, right? We're passionate about politics. We're passionate about our houses. We're passionate about sports and family and entertainment and education and cars. And all those things are fine and great. But my goodness, can we get a little bit of passion for Jesus, who died so that you might have life? I mean, you see more passion in a hockey arena. And we don't think it's weird when people clap and lift their hands and get excited and shout at a hockey game, and yet we come into church and we think, that's a little strange. That's a little awkward. For the God of all creation, who made you, designed you, gave you breath, shouldn't we be a little bit excited about that? Let's pursue the right things, namely the heart of God. So we're going to have some time here to wrestle with the heart of God. Maybe you're not making enough time in your own life. I mean, at the very least, do it on Sunday. Leave different than you came in. Wrestle with the heart of God. Say, God, I will not leave until you bless me. Like Jacob, that we want to be people engaged with the heart of God. This is our vision statement. This is our mission statement. Fully devoted, fully mature, fully alive, engaging the heart of God. This is who we want to be. And I won't give up. We're just going to keep pressing in, pressing in. So we're just going to take some time. This is a great song. I want to know you more. I want to hear your voice. I want to see your face. It reminds us of Peniel, face to face. So I just encourage you, seek the Lord, wrestle with his heart. Maybe come forward to this space, to this altar, and let's just pray. Pace around, walk around. I mean, this is God's house. It's a place to be with him. It's a place to encounter him. Let's sing one or two songs here. Dave will close us in a benediction, but let's pursue the heart of God. Maybe stand if you want, or sit, or kneel. I don't like to tell people how to respond because I want you to listen to his spirits. But these altars, of course, are always open as a place to prayer. Let's wrestle with the heart of God. Let's be like Israel, one who wrestles with God, struggles with God.